We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
This place looks vaguely familiar.
I'm starting to get worried here.
I think Maria is doing her best imitation of me with this, you know, illness that won't go away thing.
Yeah.
She spent a pretty miserable Christmas day, so we all certainly hope that she gets better soon. But I've been sick most of the month, but I'm back, by God.
All right.
Dead battery notwithstanding.
Yeah. Yeah, boy. When it rains, it pours. All right. Well, we're going to do one of the things that we do every year at this time, which we'll do at the end, is you guys regularly compose, Eat the Steak regularly composes the year's overhyped and underreported stories.
Yes, it's the most overhyped stories of the year, of which there's never any shortage, but 2009 seemed like a particularly bumper crop. And the most underreported stories of the year, which again, as there are fewer and fewer people to report them and fewer news outlets that are interested in and have the resources to actually do investigative journalism, there's no shortage of those either. So what we're going to do is I'll talk a little bit about the overhyped ones this week, since those don't require any particular insight. And then hopefully Maria will be back next week and we can both tackle the underreported ones.
Very good. All right, but prior to that, we'll get to our usual brushing of news that has happened actually over the last several weeks since you haven't been here for a while. Starting out with King County Council and Dow Constantine's replacement.
Yeah, well, there has been none. What has happened? This is really a perfect object lesson in the law of idiotic Republican initiatives. Last year, the public overwhelmingly approved an initiative that made the King County executive and the King County Council members nonpartisan in terms of the composition of the actual elected offices. And now this was all about getting Susan Hutchison elected as King County executive. And we saw how that played out this year, where Hutchison, as an arch-conservative Republican, ran as a supposed independent and, you know, builder of bipartisan consensus and blah, blah, blah. And since the position was officially nonpartisan, therefore the notion went, well, since she's never held elected office, she's nonpartisan too, as opposed to the horribly partisan Dow Constantine, who, as we all know, is a Democrat. And of course, this was all a bunch of preposterous malarkey, and the public eventually saw through it, not until the last couple of weeks of the campaign. But the unintended side consequence of this was that with five, or maybe it wasn't a side consequence, and I'll talk about that in a minute, is with five Democrats and four Republicans on the county council, if one of those Democrats needed to be replaced midterm, there would be a 4-4 tie between the Democrats and the Republicans. And just because they're no longer identified officially as Democrats and Republicans does not necessarily mean that they no longer believe what they believe. They still have their ideological and party affiliations. They're just not part of their official titles anymore. So what happened, and it's actually kind of surprising that this didn't happen last year when you had both in the governor's office and in the White House new Democratic administrations with Christine Gregoire's second term and with Barack Obama being elected. It was somewhat surprising that you didn't lose a Democratic county council member then, probably only because, you know, they're collectively they're such mediocrities. We did lose one this year with Dow Constantine winning election as the new King County executive. And lo and behold, the remaining eight county council members who are charged by the county charter with appointing the replacement to Dow's seat are deadlocked on naming a replacement because the four Democrats want to name somebody as a replacement who is representative of his district, which is to say an extremely liberal, heavily Democratic district, and the Republicans are blocking it. This actually might sound familiar because we'll talk about the same dynamic when we get to the healthcare debate, but it really points up how the consequences of that initiative, which nobody really thought through at the time that it was approved by a vote by some people thought it through and thought it was a terrible idea, but the voters didn't necessarily think it through, and so this is what we have to live with as a result. So that seat at this point, unless something fairly surprising happens, is probably going to remain unfilled, and you're probably going to have no way to break ties on the county council all the way up until November of 2010, when you can have an election to fill Dow's unfilled term. or actually to replace him. I think his term came up in 2010. So what we're going to have is that on any remotely controversial matter, we're likely facing a deadlock county council for the coming year, which is just a disaster, and it's a disaster that was created by one pretty sounding but ultimately very destructive initiative that was slipped through by the Republican. Sort of how Tim Iman passes his initiatives. They sound really nice, but then their consequences are bare, and this one has followed that model very closely.
Well, let's move on then to national and big healthcare vote this last week.
Yeah, several of them actually procedurally, but the ones that were important were the ones that the Senate passed its 60-vote hurdle with all 58 Democrats and the two independents that caucused with the Democrats, Bernie Sanders and Joe Lieberman, approving cloture on debate and approving the Senate healthcare reform package, despite the unanimous opposition of every Republican in the Senate. And this measure, I don't think it'll shock anybody to hear this, is not what it should be. I mean, first of all, the actual kind of reforms that were needed to our healthcare system were never seriously discussed in the first place, and that is that it shouldn't even be an employer-based system. Because what job you have has absolutely nothing, zero, zilch, nada to do with how society should treat people when we get sick, which is happens to everybody at one point or another. And, and no other industrialized country, actually no other country, period, has this kind of a cockeyed system. And this was, should have been an opportunity to replace it, but that was never seriously on the table, just as it was never seriously on the table when the Clintons were talking about healthcare reform in the early 90s. What we got instead was a half-witted measure that got even more half-witted as it got whittled away by Democratic centrists and conservatives in the House and the Senate. And, you know, it's easy to pass around blame for this debacle, but there are, I think, a few important things to remember about it. First is that this bill will do some finite good on its own terms. It does abolish the ability of insurance companies to ban people for pre-existing conditions. It does abolish the process of rescission, wherein your policy suddenly gets dropped when you become sick. It does have some other reforms. It does have some money, although not nearly enough, to help people pay for the mandatory insurance that is now going to be required of everybody. But it does not have cost controls over insurance policies in it that would actually regulate what private insurers do. And you can be sure that the same industry that was responding to very rational incentives that it had to deny coverage to sick people is going to find other creative ways to deny coverage to sick people without some sort of a change or interruption in those incentives being put in place. And those incentives are fundamentally unchanged. The less people, the less companies have to cover sick people, the more money they will make. That was true before, and it led to many of the problems, and it's going to be true after this bill. That said, there are some real structural reasons why this was probably the best that could be done in these current conditions. One was the Republicans' unanimous opposition to this, which really created a 60-vote procedural threshold in the Senate. Another is the whole dynamic whereby some conservative Democrats that have been elected, even though they are anti-reproductive health care for women, and that in turn allowed the opposition to pick up Democratic senators in the House. Let's not forget that even without the 60-vote threshold in the Senate and the opposition of insurance industry whores like Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson from the great states of Hartford Insurance and Mutual of Omaha, respectively, you still would have had the House version of the health care reform bill, which, while much better, only passed by 2 votes, and those 2 votes were only made possible by the inclusion of a really fairly radical anti-abortion amendment that was put in by Bert Stupak and some allies. One way or another, until you can somehow either change the rules of Congress so that the the will of the majority is more likely to become law, or you change the way that people are elected so that money does not play such an important part in who gets into office in the first place, and people don't wind up in the pockets of these enormous for-profit companies. You're probably not going to be able to do much better than this on a lot of the major policy issues of the day. And that is very, very discouraging when it comes to issues like climate change, where politics as usual simply will not cut it.
All right. Well, that moves us on then to the subject of climate change and Copenhagen.
Yeah, well, the good news is that unlike his predecessor, Barack Obama does believe that climate change exists, and he is willing to address it using multilateral measures. The bad news is that in the case of Copenhagen, the way that Obama used multilateral measures was to band together with other major polluting countries, in particular ones in the third world like China and India and Brazil, in order to kill meaningful multilateral reform. Copenhagen was a disaster. It really underscored that the governments of this world are not going to take meaningful action in anywhere near the depth that is needed, the radicalness that is needed, or the time frame that is needed in order to meaningfully address the problem as this planet slowly roasts itself to death, or actually not so slowly. And by the way, since we are in the midst of the second major cold snap in the last month here, and you know, more snowstorms back east, which have also been happening this month. My favorite on that way, by the way, it was an AP story when the big snowstorm hit the eastern seaboard last week, wherein, the article did mention that a few people died, but only after it mentioned that the malls were deserted for Christmas shopping. But, you know, the favorite trope of climate change deniers is that, well, it's cold outside, so the planet must be heating up. So just to review the facts, number one, and we'll get to this when we get to overhyped stories and we talk about ClimateGate also. Number one, what climate change means also is that you have more radical turns of the weather. So you get more extreme cold waves, you get more extreme storms of any kind. The warmest November in 31 years globally occurred this year. The global climate trend since 1978 is plus about 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. November global composite temperature was about plus 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20-year average, so it's rising faster than usual. October's was about 0.5 above the 20-year average, and 2009 is on pace. That's another of the 10 years. Warmest years in recorded history, all of which have been in the last 12 years. So, you know, something bad happening, and it keeps happening faster than any of the projected scientific models tell us it's going to happen. So the fact that Copenhagen ended is such a disaster for any kind of negotiations to address this international global crisis that the United States is a major contributor to. It was very, very discouraging for, not to put too fine a spin on it, the future of the planet and all life on it.
There was healthy opposition, though, from what they were calling the G77 nations.
There were also massive protests, although we saw a new low in law enforcement response to sort of the genre of summit protesting, where people were being arrested preemptively for planning to protest, which hopefully that tactic doesn't become commonplace, because did Steven Spielberg do a movie about that sort of arrest people before they commit the crime kind of thing? And since when is protesting a crime to begin with? But there's certainly a lot of awareness that these measures and this sort of an outcome is not acceptable. But being aware that it's being blocked and that this is not the outcome that we need, as with the healthcare debate, is very different from actually having a political system that can produce results. And the latter is what we're sorely lacking right now.
All right. Anything else on
Merry Christmas.
Anything else on Copenhagen? Otherwise,
no.
Let's move on to Mexico City and developments.
Yeah,
there.
Some good news for your Christmas season. Mexico City became the first city in Latin America this past week to pass a gay marriage law. Even though the Catholic Church, which is of course very powerful down there, vociferously opposed it, and the conservative national government that George Bush helped put in office of Felipe Calderon is promising to try and pursue to have it overturned in court, but Mexico City now has been able to do what most large cities in North America have not, or most large cities in the U.S. anyway, have not, which is to legalize gay marriage. So good on them.
All right. Well, that leaves us almost half our time left for talking about this year's most overhyped stories, which...
Sure, and there's a lot to choose from. Let's start with local. My top overhyped news story of the year, which there is admittedly stiff competition for, is the virginal Amanda Knox. You know, because anywhere else the murder trial of Amanda Knox was covered, you had it either with reporters playing it straight, or especially in British and Italian media emphasizing the horrific nature of the murder. Not so in Seattle, where the former UW sorority girl was relentlessly portrayed as an innocent caught in the jaws of a hellish Italian prison system. You literally had a story in the Seattle Times a couple weeks ago whose headline was talking about Amanda Knox is scared in prison. You know, I don't really remember anybody saying that about Charles Manson. I mean, it's just, you know, this woman has been convicted on the basis of some not unconvincing evidence of having a part in a really horrific crime. And, you know, you just cannot imagine local media taking that kind of an angle with, say, just to pick a random example, Maurice Clemens. I mean, you know, here you had a guy who was a misunderstood, struggling, small businessman, and yet people portrayed him as this ruthless cop killer. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm sure he had a family that was concerned about him and yada, yada, yada. Yet you just can't imagine it. Now, the fact that Maurice Clemens wasn't young and pretty and didn't come from a rich family and happened to be African American, I mean, those things couldn't pop. And, you know, Amanda Knox is white and comes from a rich family and is young and relatively attractive. I can't imagine that had anything at all to do with it. This is a story that was from last summer, so it will seem a little bit outdated this past week, but the fact that light rail opened as far as Tukwila this past summer, but not as far as the airport. That happened in the week before Christmas. But, you know, this was, yes, it is the first step in a portion of a public transit package that really should have happened about 40 years ago in this city, but didn't. And yes, from that standpoint, it was significant. But, yeah, the new line from downtown Seattle to Tukwila really only affects and is useful for a relatively small portion of the area's population. It just wasn't that big a deal. But you never would have known it from all the celebratory huzzas that went on. And of course, part of that also, and the whole reason that, that it was opened early, even though it wasn't, completed all the way until the airport, is that Greg Nichols wanted it to be open and wanted to get all the credit for it as a way of helping his reelection campaign. That didn't exactly work out either.
That fell short as well.
Yes, exactly. Didn't quite get all the way into the station with that one. let's see. This. Meanwhile, speaking of Greg Nichols' career being ended, somebody needs to alert local media that his career was not ended because people were unhappy because of the city response to last December's snowstorm. This seemed to be a favorite trope of media analysis of why Nichols was in trouble and then why he didn't survive the primary. And yeah, some people were upset over that. The snowstorm, it was a record snowstorm, but you also had arterials that still had snow and ice on them a week after, you know, a snowstorm, which is just inexcusable. But that being said, Nichols was unpopular before those snowstorms. You know, he was unpopular in 2005 when Al Runty, who might loosely be characterized as a bit of an eccentric, managed to get well over a third of the vote against him. That is your basic core vote that was voting against Greg Nickels 4 years ago, and his popularity did nothing but diminish over the intervening 4 years. So, you know, there were a number of factors, I think, that led to Nickels' removal, and the snowstorm and the city's response to it, and even the fact that the arterials nearest Greg Nickels' house in West Seattle seemed to have no problem getting themselves cleared, I think those were actually relatively less significant portions of Nickels' downfall. Similarly, and this is something that Maria talked about a lot in this show, the whole media coverage over the ideas that Boeing wasn't going to site its new 787 plant here in the area because the unions were being unreasonable in their demand that they not strike and not accept wage cuts. This is nonsense. You know, the average line worker in the Puget Sound region for Boeing makes $28 an hour. The average line worker in South Carolina for Boeing makes $14 an hour right now. Unless the unions and all of the people who rely economically on unions were willing to cut more than half of their salaries, Boeing was going to move that plant. It was an absolute strict calculation based on labor costs, and if Boeing could politically feasibly move their plant to Cameroon and pay workers $3 a month, they would do it. You know, it had nothing whatsoever to do with union and trans unions. That in particular was a hobby horse of Seattle Times publisher Frank Blethyn, who still seems bitter about the 2000 newspaper strike and tends to try and take it out on organized labor whenever he has a chance, no matter how implausible or irrational the narrative might be. And then finally, as usual, we had, for overhyped news stories, locally, car crashes, fires, violent crimes, big and not so big weather events, heartwarming stories of photogenic, plucky survivors, preferably kids overcoming adversity, and every other stable of local chuckle buddy TV news. And vampires. Anything with vampires in it. Or health insurance companies, which is, you know, roughly the same thing.
On a bigger scale, though.
Yes, exactly.
All right. How about nationally?
Nationally, there was a lot to choose from. First, we have the unending category, which figures prominently in overhyped national stories every year, which is celebrities. So, celebrity overhyped story number one this year will be Michael Jackson's death. He hadn't made a good album in 25 years, so, you know, just get over it. celebrities number two is Tiger Woods. A fabulously wealthy and successful pro athlete turns out to have a sense of entitlement and a surplus of testosterone. I am shocked. Shocked I am. although, you know, I do think his wife coming after him with a four iron or whatever it was is pretty funny. On a more serious note, you know, we had, and this was one of Maria's favorites for war hype stories, the collapse of the U.S. auto industry. Aside from the fact that the U.S. auto industry has not known to make a decent car that gets more than about 6 miles per gallon since 1973, if even then, you know, it probably should have happened a lot sooner. But even though it didn't, you know, number one, it didn't collapse. A couple of companies ran into financing problems during a credit crunch and wound up getting some money from the federal government as a result. But, you know, they're still in business. This is something that I referred to a little while ago, ClimateGate, the whole brouhaha which is being seized upon by climate change deniers that for... British scientists fudged their data on climate change. You know, so what? 40,000 scientists haven't fudged their data on climate change, and they are not, I repeat, not all in on the conspiracy. So we had that. The whole hype around the nuclear weapon capacity of Iran when they're not even close, and there's still as yet no evidence, even within the IAEA, that Iran actually is trying to develop nuclear weaponry as opposed to simply nuclear power. The party crashes at the White House. I suppose this should have gone under the celebrity category. You know, again, a bunch of money can get you in the door anywhere you want to go. How is this news? The This is another one that's a favorite of Maria's, The Jobless Recovery, which is, you know, just such a complete lingual moxymoron. You know, just because some people on Wall Street are making money and just because the banks are taking all the taxpayer money and partying like it's 2005 does not mean that for the rest of us the economy isn't hurting something awful. And the fact that there's been almost no recognition of this in media coverage of the economy over the past year, you know, outside this program, is really appalling. It really is. Finally, we had several that fall into the category of the idiot brigade, which, you know, idiocy in our electoral politics, particularly in the Palinista wing of the Republican Party, seems to have become institutionalized this year, which is a whole broader and much more troubling topic. I can't really think of any other public figure who is, you know, celebrated specifically because she is so proudly ignorant and ill-informed. But why, she's just like me. She speaks for me. I don't want one of the most powerful people in the world to be just like me. I want them to be better than me. Anyway, and, you know, even with Obama, we've seen that has limits with what any one person can do. But the Idiot Brigade number one overhyped story was the town malls from this past August, where, you know, there were a few buffoons that disrupted town halls. It had no overall impact on the healthcare reform debate. It just got a lot of attention, and that attention should never have been given in the first place. Idiot Brigade number two was were the stories over Acorn and Van Jones, the corollary underreported story that Glenn Beck is resorting to McCarthyism and has been making a pretty good living doing it. But you know, Acorn did not invent votes. You know, they had people who fraudulently tried to add voter names to the registrar, but unless people showed up to use those voter registrant names, which none did, it would have had no impact other than defrauding Acorn itself. It really wasn't a story. And then Idiot Brigade number three is Sarah Palin's ghostwritten book, and her ghostwritten, you know, anybody who has to have her Facebook page ghostwritten is really pretty lame.
All right. Well, that just leaves us a couple minutes left. Any on the international scope you want to touch on? Or
well, those were national and international. Okay. with climate gate and, yeah, and the Iran nukes and so forth.
Very good. Okay, talking with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and in addition to letting us know where people can find Eat the State, you also are looking at your year-end fundraiser.
Yes, and we are hurting for money. Eat the State is a volunteer publication that's been coming out for 13 years or so, and it's always been a shoestring operation where we don't know really from one issue to the next whether we have enough money. But at this point, you know, we've been doing a fund drive for about a month, and the results have been very poor. We're definitely being victimized by the economy just along with everybody else. But it really, I think, is at this point endangering our capacity to continue publishing the print edition, which would be a real shame. But at this point, we're several thousand dollars in debt to the printer, and the money we've had coming in from this fund drive isn't enough even to cover our current issues, much less put a dent in that debt to the printer. So, you know, normally you can find Eat the State at bookstores and cafes and the King County Library System and such, but not trying to be alarmist here, I'm just being realistic. You know, unless we have our many and loyal readers step up to the plate as the year closes and in the next weeks, you know, we're probably going to have to look at discontinuing the print edition, which, when we get to the underreported stories of 2009, that, you know, the death of print journalism is going to be one of them. We're hoping people will step up because we do really want to keep publishing. You know, we have an irrational love of newsprint and the idea that you could physically hold something in your hands and that people might pick it up serendipitously who didn't even know they were going to be interested in it, which you can't do on the internet.
Right. Black stuff all over your fingers.
Exactly. Yeah, we miss those mailing parties. So we do hope people will step up. You can go to our website, which is www.eatthestate.org. You can give a donation there versus PayPal. We have no paid staff. You know, we have almost no overhead. Almost all of the money goes directly into printing and distributing the paper. So it really is a good cause. If you need to make a tax-deductible donation, we have an umbrella group. You can email us and get more information on how to do that at info@eatthestate.org. You can go to our website, which is www.eatthestate.org. And in addition to all the fine news and opinions and humor and all the rest of it that you'll see, there is a PayPal button there for donations. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way with the snail mail and send a donation to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. That's Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145.